Let's go ahead and start by one of you just starting with where you were born, and we'll go from there.
Why don't you start, because your family's been here for 120 some years. So.
Okay, my mother's father died in South Dakota, causing my grandmother and her three kids, including my mother, to move to the West Coast where her sister was.
Mm-hmm.
The girls all emigrated from Norway. Mm-hmm. And then they settled momentarily in Chehalis, where my father, who was born on Anderson Island in 1903, was working as a guard, if you want to call it that, at the what was then called the State Training School. And he was working in the chicken business and so forth, and on the side, he started a chicken business with grandmother's sister. Well, he met through the business at my mother, squired her, married her, and here I am.
Ta-da!
In the meantime, my grandmother's sister was married and adopted Gail.
Mm-hmm.
So we're adopted second cousins.
When father moved to the island in the Depression, he lost his business. He came out to the island and got a job with my grandfather's old friend C.B. Hopkins, who made my father the caretaker of Hopkins Ranch, which was the property between the two lakes and most of Lake Josephine. Grandmother Anderson had rented a place on Sandbeck Road, and later in 1936 purchased the property on Larson Road, which we still have. Gail and I took naps when her adopting mother would visit her sister, my grandmother, at Larson, and before then, on the porch, or on the when we were 2, 3, 4 years old.
Well, we were younger than that.
Yeah.
So because we're a year and a half apart in age.
Mm-hmm.
So from babyhood on,
mm-hmm.
we were best friends, and always had a lot of fun.
So she would visit the island in the summertime, and as we got big enough to have bicycles, we rode bikes, and we would. Of course, bicycle up to the swimming hole, which was the Engwall place now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had his and hers huckleberry bushes where we changed. And the longest hour in human existence is the hour between lunch and the time you can go swimming. And that, of course, was what my grandmother insisted upon. Of course, what she really wanted was an hour siesta after lunch to keep us quiet and to rest.
But she had us totally convinced that if you went in that water 59 minutes after you ate, you'd sink to the bottom and die. 60 was okay. 59, no. No way.
59 and 30 seconds would not work either.
No, it would not.
And if we didn't want to ride our bicycles, why, it was to plead and cajole with Uncle Pliny to drive us up in the Model A two-door sedan.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go up there and swim for a couple, 3 hours. There'd be other kids there sometimes not. There was a float out there, so it was a big deal when we first started to swim out to the float, and I had a diving board on and be brave enough to dive off the end of the diving board.
Oh, and Jerry had goggles, said he could see underwater, swimming goggles.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so envious because, the reason he had them was because his eyes were very sensitive to the water, and I thought that was, once in a while he'd let me wear them, but not too often, but it was okay. But I was so envious of those. What else? You had a sailor cap, one of those white things? And he didn't let anybody wear that very much either. But I got to wear that and hold his BB gun, which was totally... I'll tell you. Even then, at like age 8, 10, he was...
So where'd you like us to go from here?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to hear more about the swimming hole.
Well,
do you have any funny stories about being well, Gordon?
I have a story about Viv Johnson.
Gordon.
Okay.
I think I must have been probably eight or ten. And Viv was a little bit older, not much. But she was down there, and you know, Viv talks with her hands. And she had on two rings. A red stone and a blue stone. And I remember admiring those rings because I liked rings. And she was waving her hands around, and they both flew into an area which we didn't swim in because it was kind of mucky on the bottom, into that mud. Well, I spent the whole rest of the afternoon trying to find those for her. Never did. No, never did. But I still remember her shrieking and saying, "My rings, my rings!" And she'd lost them in the mud. But
the whole afternoon spent trying to find them.
Yeah.
The swimming hole was a real gathering place in that there was always an end-of-school picnic,
mm-hmm.
and that was more or less an island potluck, and the same with 4th of July, and usually in June and July after work, after haying and things like that, the whole families, for that matter, would come up and have a before supper dip at the lake and so forth. Junior Johnson had removed the chassis from an old car, whatever it was, I don't know, and made a bug with his Debs was plastic, so he used lath and canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And made a car out of it, and a nifty airfoil type car it was at that. And of course, without a muffler, very little, so it was noisy. And he and the canvas boys would rat around in that and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as I recall, it was Earl Parr that had gotten a similar bug. It was painted, as I recall, yellow and red.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Model T, as I recall. But it too was sort of a Bugatti shape,
mm-hmm.
you know, with a boat tail and things like that. It was also a major attraction, and as I recall, it had a great huge fire alarm bell. The bell itself was probably 14, 18 inches in diameter,
mm-hmm.
and it really clanged when he'd hit the switch for it.
Yeah.
And of course, he'd come down the bumpy road to the swimming hole with the bell clanging, and we all knew that Earl was showing up.
Funny.
And the swimming hole was just a gathering place most of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think we have some pictures of it, of the last kids standing on the float somewhere. I'm gonna have to go through.
We island kids kind of looked down our noses at the mainlanders that come over to use our swimming hole.
No.
As that we
still
did.
Yes.
Don't you though?
I won't deny it.
But how the times change.
So your family worked on the Hopkins farm. So when did that start? How old were you?
I was born in St. Joseph's Hospital in July 1930, and came immediately to the island. The folks, of course, the freshman was 29,
mm-hmm.
and the folks were married in 29, and Dad and Mom planted those two sets of trees. Those are actually, each one is a set of three trees,
mm-hmm.
In front of the home place. And they planted those, I think, on the event of their marriage or shortly thereafter. And they immediately went to the lake's place, to Hopkins Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly when he started, I don't know, but of course, having gotten married and having a kid on the way and the depression hitting and losing his chicken business and things like that and losing his job in the state training school, everything collapsed for him.
Mm-hmm.
So here was home.
And he got $25 a month. For working at Hopkins. And he would plant a garden. Hopkins lived east of the mountains.
In Spokane.
And he would plant the garden for them. He would tend the animals that they had. I'm sure they had a cow.
They had four cows and they had a bunch of chickens. And
I remember that house. It was a great house.
We were burned out in 1933. As a matter of fact, the story of that, if somebody continue with that, is that it was about the day or the day before the Volstead Act was repealed, which was the Prohibition Act. And at that time, some pilots had to make a forced landing on what is now in the vicinity of Bertie Sturm's house and things like that. It was a 5-acre field at that time. So they set the airplane down in the 5-acre field. They had their problems and they were working on it. But the Volstead Act was repealed and the folks went to Ernie Eriks, which was then your neighbor's Johnson Landing, four party. That they left the airplane mechanics there. It was in the autumn or fall or winter of the year. I'm not sure when. Anyway, they left the airplane people at the house and told them about the dampers or something like that in the house. To make a long story short, the house burned down while the folks were at the party.
The Hopkins house, or your house?
Our house was separate from the Hopkins house.
Right.
And so that was burned totally to the ground. Our dog, a part collie, part shepherd, part wolfhound named Monty, had been left stuck inside, and he was underneath the porch steps when they got back, and he was singed, and forever after his voice was cracked from having barked so hard and so long to get out. But Monty was about the only thing. A few pictures were about the only thing that were saved from there. So after getting started with a family depression, while having another slam, being burned out was a major trauma. A later anecdote about that is that I guess I was about four or five, and there were boathouses on both lakes, and I was going down to Lake Florence to play in the water, which 3 or 4 year old kids must do. Well, Monty would stand in my way, and I recall beating on his back to get around him, and he wouldn't move. He wouldn't let me go.
And
I think Mama told him to take care of Jerry.
But anyway. That was the story there.
Well, there was another story about Monty that was funny too, because your folks had gone to town, and I don't know how old you were at this point, but probably in your before teens. And Monty was left home. Well, Monty loved to tree anything that was furry and ran. So he got, I guess it was a coon, up a tree. Probably about 10 minutes after the folks left, and they were going to be gone all weekend. That dog, his mother said, when they got back, could not bark. He was so hoarse, and he had worn a furrow around the tree. And the coon was still up there, so Dad came out and shot him out of the tree.
Right.
That was a poop puppy, I'll tell you.
No, she said his voice was never the same after that. Even, you know, the fire did bad enough, but this barking for this entire weekend just did him in.
I remember we had
an airplane ride at age 10. They were living at the lakes, and we had come out, my adopted mother had come out to visit his grandmother, her sister, and somebody from Chehalis, I believe, came in with a float plane. Oh, well, you would be the pilot, but I just was in awe. So this thing landed on the lake. It taxied on up to the boathouse right down below Hopkins. And we have pictures of Jerry and I hanging over the pontoons. We'd been swimming, of course. And for some reason or another, I still to this day do not believe that my adopted mother allowed me a ride in that plane. We both got a ride, and I'll tell you, thrill number 973. It was absolutely marvelous.
The second reinforcement to my becoming a pilot, because the first one was when I mentioned those guys that flew the airplane, or landed the airplane. I recall being set on the wing of this two-wing biplane monoplane, biplane, and then running up the engine. Well, I didn't like the engine. I cried and cried, but I wouldn't get off the airplane. I wanted to stay there. But I didn't like the sound.
We didn't like the sound.
And, of course, then this ride, and also where... Basically, where Cooler Park Airfield is, Votech, and things like that, there's Mueller Harkins Airport. And so the folks go to town and do the shopping and things like that when they had to or could have had money enough to do so. Anyway, I'd always bug them to stop by Mueller Harkins for a while so we'd watch the airplanes come and go.
Very neat.
I remember that always airplanes were important. Rebuilding model airplanes.
What do you remember about growing up in the Depression? Then
I don't remember
ever being
felt feeling poor.
We had
chickens.
We had chickens.
Matter of fact,
my adopted mother had 3,000 chickens.
And of course,
that kind of went belly up during the Depression. But we always had chickens to eat. We had a cow.
We grew vegetable garden.
Canned a lot of stuff.
I don't remember feeling poor.
Or hungry.
I think we were probably more fortunate
than a lot of people,
because we weren't city people.
We didn't have to depend on a city job or anything.
I'd have some holes in my shoes, but they never had that put cardboard in the bottoms or anything. Then I don't know why, I probably inherited from my mother. I never liked to go barefoot.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. And she'd go running across the stubble hayfield, no problem, and I'd be ooching and ouching.
For me. Yeah.
I don't remember that.
One kind of a funny story. You know where Viv Gordon used to live?
On Larson Road.
Actually, where in the vicinity of where Kathy Isaacson lives now.
Oh, okay.
That was where Viv was raised, that area there, Tin City and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the Johnsons and my folks were real good friends and card playing buddies and things like that. And Liv and I were about the same age, and so we were, of course, buddies. And another little aside is that she had a brother who was the middle child called Doug Gerald or Jerry. And of course, it was Johnny the oldest. Well, that Jerry was Big Jerry, and I was Little Jerry for the longest time. I never really liked being little. But the story is that I was bored around the house, and my mom was busy doing things, and Dad was in the garden, or what, I don't know, it was summertime, and I'll go down and see Viv.
So Monty and I hiked on out, and we got down there.
And I imagine by the time I got there, because quite a stroke for walking, especially for a little kid. Mom was rather frantic.
I didn't realize this until later.
But when I showed up, Alice says, "Oh, hi, and how are you?" And where's Viv? And so I found Viv, but she called the folks and says, "You know, Jerry's down here." But also, I think at the same time, that relieved mother. But I think father had also got looking for dog prints.
And he followed Monty's footprints as mine all the way down.
And then we got to the corner of Larson Road up here in Yeoman. I was being sent home. Alice said that I had better go home because my folks were worried about me. So I'm muttering along, and I'm just about opposite Searle's place.
And I see Dad coming around the corner,
and I see he's got a switch in his hand.
And I called out, "I see you, Daddy.
I see your switch." Well, I got turned around and accelerated home a little bit. It was not a vicious beating or anything like that, but I got reminded that I should have done that.
You should have been aware of where you were going, or at least telling people where you were going.
Was that the occasion where you made the comment about to hell with the Johnsons, to hell with the birds?
Yes.
You weren't very old, I don't think, at that point.
What was it like for Munchkins to be able to go and play in boats and do all that kind of stuff, living on an island?
It was cool.
Every year, it was just what you did. The most difficult thing I had to do was learn to swim 50 feet before you take the boat out, and that was I wanted to go fishing when I was 5, and Dad says, okay, well, you can go and you can swim 50 feet. Okay, well, that didn't work, so I had to just go with him when they fished.
Mm-hmm.
But I could go down and catch minnows and things like that. I had a little hook and worm and catch minnows and put them in a bucket, and we'd all go bass fishing in the other lake. Josephine was the bass lake at the time. So in the summer I was 6. Boy, I got my 50 feet, and I got my rod, and I got my boat permit, and I was gone. as kids do, all by yourself, mucking around and so forth. Well, I slip off logs, and they get wet, and they come back to the house and say, "Hi, Mom, here's your drowned rat."
I remember you coming out, and at that point, I remember the little house that your grandmother lived in, right above, just up from Ivel's, sort of up the hill from where Papa Bear used to live. And it seemed to me when I was tiny, three or so, that was the longest house in the world inside. I thought the room was terribly long. Well, it was just a little tiny thing.
You still see it.
Yeah, it's still up there, but it's kind of trash now. But you'd walk in, I remember, the barn was 5 times bigger than the house. And we have pictures, too. I ought to get some of those pictures out for you. I'm going to see if I can't find them. Because we have pictures of both of us at that house and at this house down here, and a lot of the relatives, because we had the same relatives. But anyway, I remember walking into that house, and there was a long room, and it was kind of kitchen and I guess dining room. But then you went up a step, and that to me was terribly intriguing.
The biggest step in the world. We were so big, we could make that step.
Oh gosh, yes. And that went up to the bedrooms.
And I step was only about 8 inches high.
You know, and they had a bath with a path, of course. So there was no plumbing in the house. An outdoor pump, I remember.
And cold water.
And I remember somebody daring me to put my tongue on the pump handle. And I think I did it once. Just once. I think it was probably you that did it, too, turkey. But those were. And we went down here.
Well, go play
on the beach. You know, the adults wanted to sit around and talk adult talk.
But we were never bored.
We would build elaborate forts and sand castle type things and embellish them with clam shells and agates and all kinds of wonderful stuff.
And we'd sneak out a few matches and cook in a little tiny fire, maybe no more than 4 or 5 inches across.
With rocks around on the beach. And put this big horse clam shell on there with salt water. Then we'd go find ourselves a little crab and poke him in there and cook him. Yes. We never ate him. You know, we just like to see him turn red.
And writhed too, right?
Yes, oh, they writhed beautifully.
How about did you guys ever go and play on Eagle Island or anything like that? Were you allowed to do that when you were young?
Yeah, we did. I remember going to Eagle.
But we, at that time, there's so many clams in front of the house.
We didn't need to, but I think
we went over there to look at the light
and so forth.
But your folks
used to go over there and pick up that shell that gets kind of really small and crushed, the barnacle shells, and bring them back for their chickens.
They have the calcium in them
and salt too, which the chickens liked.
And in fact, I did that when we had our chickens here.
A little bit, I'd go down and pick up a lot of those shells. But Eagle was, there's one, that one spot right across from you that has the nice white
beach.
Yeah, still there.
And they would go and get their shell.
That's interesting. I never really thought about that.
But it was a good source of calcium for them. And it worked just fine.
How about the Indian burial ground that was there or supposedly there? Did you guys hear much about it?
I don't remember hearing anything about it.
There were some
arrowheads around, but there was always so scarce and so much undergrowth and things like that I had better things to do than plow around the dirt.
Well, your Uncle Rupert used to get arrowheads down below here. And I remember as a kid, he had a shoebox full of arrowheads. And I think they all got destroyed in the fire when the home place burned in 1984.
A story about the arrowheads, I think, where that little gully is there, by Arlene's and so forth. I'm not sure there's a stream there or not, but that tells of the squaws and Indians coming from the island on their way to Puyallup for salmon fishing and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a halfway point with them. They come in their canoes and they camp out here.
Mm-hmm.
And they language barrier and things like that. Mm-hmm. And to make a long story short, they'd trade salmon for grandma's homemade bread.
Oh, really?
And I don't know how it worked out, whether they took the bread and so forth, or mm-hmm. how it was offered or whatever, I don't know the bartering of it. Dad didn't get really that involved with it, but because it was a tale from his childhood.
Right.
So you lose a lot in translation.
Translation and
yeah,
time.
And time.
What did his mother think about all that?
I think she was a little afraid of them.
I think she was a little apprehensive, but she didn't. There wasn't much she could do. She had an older daughter and three boys. So they were probably hanging around the house. She had seven children altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be people around. I think basically the Indians were harmless anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They're just very childish and naive, and they see something they want it, and if they want it, they go get it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have two, they'll take one, or maybe both of them, and so forth. But that's how the air has been.
But your Grandpa Berg was an amazing man. I barely remember him. I remember he was short and barrel-chested, and he had hands like hams.
Mm-hmm.
And
he had a mustache, just like
Vernon.
And he slurped that coffee, and the coffee stained his mustache.
Yes. But he did so much. I mean, he logged all of, because this, where we are, that field was all full of trees when he got here, because he homesteaded, a quarter section, which is 160 acres or something. Dad used to tell the story about 4th of July, you probably heard it at school, or maybe he came up and talked to you when you were a little kid. Oh, okay. Anyway, that's the way the kids knew 4th of July was there, because he'd go out and he'd stick some dynamite under one of these stumps, which he had to get out of the ground anyway, and he'd blow the stump out of the ground.
I saw that one time, maybe 4, 5, 6 years old.
Mm-hmm. But he planted a huge garden. He made his kids' shoes. We still have some of the last that belonged to his shoemaking kit. He always managed to make toys for the kids at Christmas time. He would take his vegetables and row them across to the mainland to sell them.
Wow.
And his feed and things like that for the animals, before there was a ferry, would come in by barge or vessel of some sort. And Dad tells of him picking up two 120-pound sacks of feed and walking from the shore up to the barn.
Yes, very strong man. Very strong man.
Yeah. Jeez, that's a long walk, too.
That's a heavy walk.
And uphill.
Yeah.
All the way.
And we have a picture of the home place with manicured hedges and garden. It was just gorgeous.
Yeah, where those trees are, he had a privet hedge on both sides of the road of the trail going straight
leading
down
up to the house.
And the lawn was mowed like Kenny has it. And I recall, as a youngster, my cousin and I somersaulting down the hill.
Wow. What an awful lot of work.
It was a tremendous amount of work. I don't know how the man found enough hours in the day. And then he had seven kids.
And he had, on the other side of the driveway here was the first chicken house, mm-hmm. and it was the same size as this chicken house. And Dad helped build it in 1930 when he had come back from the training school.
Mm-hmm.
So the chicken house that's still here is a replica of the other
one.
And as a youngster, I recall both of them being full of chickens. And
I think your grandma worked awful hard, too.
Seven kids, all that laundry, and
yeah.
All the meals, I couldn't imagine. Ooh.
Yeah.
When you work outside like that, too, you don't just eat a sandwich either.
No. I think they were good, hearty meals.
Yeah.
Wow. That just seems like immense.
Real pioneering people.
So, do you remember any of, or hear heard stories about the grocery boats or anything that would come?
I think it was the Indian and the Chinook. There were three of them.
The Vaughn was.
No, that was Ernie's boat.
Okay, that was Ernie's. I'm sorry.
But the ferry dock, the original ferry dock, was designed that way, with the dock at an angle to the main dock. So that the ferry could come in and make the turn for the vehicles to make the turn, the commercial vessels could land side by side, side to the dock, because they had elevators,
and so they could
run the elevator up and down and come to the edge no matter where the tide was. So they run the elevator up to the edge of the dock, and they had a ramp and hand trucks, and that's how Ernie got his gasoline for the store.
Mm-hmm.
And of course everything else that he had in the store came in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier on, he had this vessel of Vaughan, and he brought the groceries back. The groceries and things like that, back and forth. But the people produced here, he'd take them down and bring back.
Mm-hmm.
I remember rowing down to Johnson's Landing when it was Ernie's store,
mm-hmm.
and climbing up the ladder to get into the store with our nickel or three pennies or whatever it was we had, and press your nose against the candy counter, and took a long time to decide.
Because there weren't that many pennies.
But
we had to make sure
we get the right kind that lasted a long time.
Right.
Now let's see what else.
She accuses me, and I'm not sure if it's right or not.
It was right.
we'd take turns because we were both kids, and didn't make that much difference. I'd row one way, and she'd row the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she accused me of rowing with the tide, and making sure the rows.
He did. Took me until I was 15 years old to figure out that he was rowing with the tide, and I was rowing against it. That's why I was having such a bad time. I just thought he was being chivalrous, and all will row one way.
Right.
Right.
Sounds like you were quite the prankster.
He was.
Whatever.
What kind of stuff did they carry in the stores then?
I don't remember. I think it was a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. Really, it was.
I remember looking up and seeing like kerosene lamps.
Mm-hmm. It was a hardware store.
Rope. He had a great big pickle barrel, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the candy counter was our main concern.
Some meats, I think, that he.
It seemed to be cheese. I remember cheese.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a. Maybe a little 7-8 foot long regular display case, cooler display case. I think, he had an electric plant.
Mm-hmm.
There's no electricity at that time, so he had an electric plant, and that's how he ran the cooler and so forth. But the thing, Ernie was a machinist as well as a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the main part of the building was his machine shop, and he had one electric motor, large electric motor, and he ran a lathe. I don't know what other things he had, a drill press. He had numerous things that you see over here at the White's now, some of the old equipment.
He ran with belts and pulleys, and he'd have shifting levers that he'd shift the pulley from one, or shift the belt from one pulley to another to take a, to get a new implement to use.
And he was an amazing man.
Wow, ran everything off that one motor.
Yeah, with belts and pulleys and blocks and shivs and so forth.
That's neat.
It was incredible.
Mm. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, let me think. I have something I want to give you after. Well, not give to you, but I will loan it to you, and you make copies of it.
Okay.
I have a few stories that are written by Ruth Owen Summer, or Somerville Owen, who was a teacher 1931-32. She lives in University Place. She's 97 years old, has a mind like a steel trap still. She's very frail. Right? She was great friends. She and her husband were great friends with Jerry's parents. And I think your dad was on the school board or something when she came out and became teacher.
She stayed at Warner's.
She stayed at Warner's place.
Which is, now where Hicks, well, somewhere between Hicks and Shrum's.
Anyway, she wrote for me several of her experiences when she first came to the island, how she learned to drive on the island. And they're just priceless. She also gave me some poems she's written just recently. I usually talk to her once or twice a week on the phone, just make sure she lives alone, still in her own house. Very frail, but her mind is just, she can recite poems that she taught her first class when she was like 17 and started to teach.
Wow. That's amazing.
It is. Amazing.
I don't know if Spanish Line was her first school. But it was
no, it wasn't. She taught around Tenino somewhere, I believe, at first, but it was close.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I will let you take those and read them
where you really want to go. So.
That's okay. That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, a little bit. But
I might have to see if I can contact her too.
Yes.
That would be great.
She loves to talk.
That'd be
you
great.
Call Ruth and you listen to Ruth for an hour and a half.
Right.
Actually, it would be great if you could go to her home.
With a documentary project, where you'd just be close in her arms.
Oh, she would love you to death. She loves to talk about the old times.
And I've taken her. Anyone academically interested is even more precious.
Yes. She was a teacher for over 60 years.
Wow.
And she retired, then she went back to teaching. But I would, when she was well enough or, you know, agile enough, would take her up to school. And the kids would all ask her questions about what it was like to be in the one-room schoolhouse. And, well, you went there, your dad went there.
Wow.
And she tells tales about, sending the kids with a milk can to bring back the next day because everyone had a cow.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the kids didn't have hot lunches. So she'd make cocoa for them on the little round stove.
A pot-belly stove, so she'd put the milk on the stove.
Yeah. And when she told the kids up here that was the one thing they remembered
was
about the cocoa, making and wondered why Mrs. Ritchie didn't do that.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So what was school like that like for you guys out here?
Well, I didn't go to school out here.
You went out here.
He yeah. did.
Well, it was one room and eight grades, and the teacher sat in the back of the room with a desk, and as I recall, there were two, maybe 5-6 foot benches of the old park bench type, the sort of rounded seat and so forth, slatted, iron ends. And she would conduct grades there. And so you would, when she called you, well, you go back for your session.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd, I'd call standing by her desk and trying to read C Spot Run. and in later years, why she'd have some of the older kids in their class. And of course, I had a rubber ear listening to them too, and then she'd ask them questions, and other the students there knew it. I raised my hand. But there was time for study, and I wouldn't call them recitations, but there was a brief, if you want to call it that. There was assignments that you did in school. There really wasn't homework.
Mm-hmm.
But And then you're given time to read what was assigned, and then you go back and discuss it and so forth. I guess there were tests. There were tests. I don't really recall tests, but I don't recall being apprehensive. Maybe that's why I don't know.
I don't remember the tests. Mm-hmm.
But I remember one incident in the first grade, and there, of course, was a blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was left-handed. And so, as you're supposed to do with young kids, you know, write on the blackboard the sentence or do some of the sentence. So I dice with my left hand right, and I changed my left hand to the right hand. And it was never very good. And so they said, okay, now, Jerry, you write this on the board with your left hand. Okay, now you write the same thing on the board with your right hand. Okay, Jerry, now which one is better? I guess with my right hand. Okay, from now on, you write with your right hand.
That's funny.
So I still shotgun with my left hand.
You still eat with your left hand.
And I bat right-handed. I bowl left-handed. I golf right-handed.
Wow, that's funny.
And, there was, when I got there was Lowell Johnson and I think Bob Eric and the
Ralph Christensen.
Ralph and the,
Cannons.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all there about to the Odin. Even I'm not sure if Bob Cannon was there as well or not. But I was a little kid, and they were there.
They were the big kids. Huh?
Oh, you betcha. And the only sports we played was workup baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And being a little kid, I was always in the outfield, never got a chance to bat, so I don't care for baseball to this day for that. and we went from I think around 13 or so is the maximum number of kids in school to two. One was the year there was two. Then with my seventh grader, part of it, Rosella Parr and I were the only two kids in school.
Wow!
And we were in the same grade.
Wow! Well, that makes it much easier for the teacher.
Oh yeah.
And Rosella was out. Relative of Agnes, Rupert's wife.
Yeah, she was Agnes's youngest sister.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really interesting. Huh. Let's see. So you're talking about like your 8 or 10 years. How about your teens, your preteens, and your teens?
Well.
We had, as we come up from the beach, we had the big old huckleberry bush, and we'd have a kiss behind the huckleberry bush before we come in.
We dated when we were in high school. I went to Annie Wright, and he was at Clover Park. And,
it was never really serious, but I think it was just figuring out what a kiss was and so forth.
Yeah, but then we both went off and married someone else and for 25 years.
But my preteens were pretty much started in Steilacoom because we moved off the island in 43 when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
So most of it was with Clover Park and so forth. Clover Park was a junior senior high school at the time.
What was your family doing then? Your parents?
The war came along and Dad was of an age where he really couldn't be in the military, but he was told to get a war central job, because what on the island was not considered war central.
Mm-hmm.
So he got a job at Chambers Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall that we had cows at the time, and Mother was milking, and he would come home on the last boat, which I think was leave here at 5 o'clock, get over to 5:30, and get back here at 6 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So Mother would do most of the milking, and I would try to milk and strip and things like that. Stripping means finishing off the last little bit of the milk out of the cow.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even though I was 12 and 13 years old, we had a 31 Model A. And when Mother needed the car for things, you know, shopping on the island or whatever, why, she'd take Dad to work. We caught the first boat. But sooner or later, I got to drive.
Mm-hmm.
So I would drive down, big time, drive the Model A down, pick up that at the ferry.
At the ferry dock.
But
where were you?
As far as when you were 13 when you moved off the island?
Yeah.
And you went to Clover Park. When you moved off the island, did your parents change jobs or you just...
Well, that's where I was. In that then it became impossible really for... And the work we were doing, Gail mentioned we were getting $25 a month at the time. I think at one point in the maybe 39 that was raised to 35. And before Dad quit, well, I was up to $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That really wasn't happening, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just because I was time for high school anyway, the decision was just to move off and be done with it. So he got the Chambers Creek job, and then we moved into a house just back of where Dad later had bought and where we built, there at Fredrickson's College in Silicon.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the 13th of November, I recall, and I was pushing my bike up the hill, and that was my first night in town.
Wow.
In my house, yeah.
Wow.
But my first job came shortly after that, because up at the top of the hill, we were renting from